Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That was one of the themes that I kept coming back to, which is that like panic is potentially as big of a problem as the actual disease itself. And I guess I was kind of telling myself that.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts.
Hello, welcome to War College. I am your host, Matthew Galt. Normally I have a written intro here up at the top, or kind of go down points, but we're living in odd times, and I decided I kind of wanted to speak off the cuff to you, the listeners. As I'm sure all of you are aware, we are in the middle of a pandemic, actually probably more likely at the beginning of a pandemic. By the time you hear this, don't know how bad or how much better things could get. One thing I do know is that a couple times in our life, we are going to live through moments of great change. And I think we are in the middle of one of those, or again, at the beginning of one of those now. And we, a lot of us don't know what's going to happen, including stupid podcasters. There are smart people that think they know a little bit about what's going to happen, but there's so many variables and so unknowns with this thing that, you know, we don't know what our life is going to be like in a year and how it's going to have changed. But I know that we'll get through it because we tend to get through these things. And here to help us work through some of that panic and some of that fear is Mike Pearl. Pearl is a journalist whose work has appeared in Vice, The Outline, The All, and The Hollywood Reporter. He's also the author of the book, The Day It Finally Happens, Alien Contact, Dinosaur Parks, and Other Possible Phenomena. Sir, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the reason I wanted to have you on the show, you know, we had talked roughly about 6 months ago, right when the book first came out, and now it finally happened, Mike.
One of the situations in the book finally happened, yeah.
One of the situations in the book finally happened. I reread that portion earlier today. It's not quite a one-to-one.
Thank you for noticing that. A lot of people are like, this is just like what's in your book. And I was like, did you read it? Did you actually read it?
No, so in your book, the situation that you outline is the day the antibiotics stop working.
Right.
And you gave it a 5 out of 5 chance. And again, we're obviously dealing with a virus and not a not bacteria, but it's similar. The situation you kind of set up and the conversations you have there's parallels here. Can you kind of talk about those a little bit?
Yeah. So when I wrote that chapter, you know, what I was trying to capture was a little bit different. It was the idea that it was very different. It was focused on the idea of bacteria becoming immune to our antibiotics. And so it was really about superbugs, and that is not what this is. This is just a regular old virus. So when I wrote that, it was also my excuse to write about a pandemic. So I did. The fictional section at the beginning of the chapter touches on you know, economic collapse and borders being shut down and all of the cool stuff that happens in, you know, all of our favorite pandemic fiction. But I didn't go into things like social distancing. I mean, maybe a tiny bit. I talk about how we are now a lot more familiar than we once were, you know, during, say, the time of the plague, the Black Plague. We're familiar with the basic methods of, you know, not acquiring a pathogen, like not stealing the clothes of people who've just died from the actual effects of the pathogen, because that will likely also kill you. Like, we know things like that, and they once did not know things like that. And that makes a huge difference when it comes to this stuff. And, you know, by the time of the Spanish flu, they also knew that. So we're not really that much, in a lot of ways, we're not really that much further along than the Spanish flu. But because of that difference, because of the difference between bacteria and viruses, and that chapter really, really was focused on bacteria, I kind of am kicking myself that I didn't find a way to work in another pathogen chapter, because, you know, it was it was just right there. And that's because the research that I did for that chapter was the sort of like the brief flirtation that I had with writing a chapter on zombies. I was gonna sort of do a bait and switch and be like, what I'm actually writing about is a virus. And then I didn't end up doing. I didn't even get very far into that. But so what we're living through now, according to the logic of my book, is my version of a zombie apocalypse. So here we are in the zombie apocalypse. Doesn't feel very fun.
There sure are a lot of good TikToks, though, right?
Well, I mean, this is really a time for the regular old reporters to shine, and for the like long read writers and the think piece writers to kind of fade into the background, and for the old fashioned just going in and telling you the facts reporters to just blow them out of the water.
I'm going to share more opinions on this show than I normally do on a typical episode of War College. Again, we're in strange times. Listener, thank you for indulging us. Op-ed writers, I think, too, probably need to get less traction right now.
Yep. Right? It is not your moment. Yeah.
No, it's not. And that's across political spectrum, in my opinion. People need to sit down and shut up. And again, let people that do actual decent, just the facts reporting to kind of come out and shine. And that's part of what's going to help us get through this. Good journalism.
Yeah.
Which is something that personally I'm worried about in my field at the moment. Everything's kind of okay right now, but again, this thing is going to have ripples throughout the entire economy, and we don't know what's going to happen. We just don't. And I think that fear of the unknown is a big part of what I'm grappling with. And again, one of the reasons I want to talk to you is that I remember in our last conversation, you told me that kind of one of the reasons that you started doing this kind of work and researching these kinds of topics and wrote this book is because when you face a fear and you learn about it, it helps you manage it. And I'm wondering how you're managing your fear at this moment.
The answer is not well. how do you, in terms of your like, anxiety level on a daily basis, like where scale of 1 to 10 or however you measure it, like where are you?
I'm a fairly anxious person, but I'm going to say an eight.
Yeah. I think that's probably about where I am. I mean, I'm feeling a lot of new emotions. Like, I'm somebody who tries to downplay the idea that like the minute like the shit hits the fan, we'll all just kill each other for the last sandwich or whatever. I have not really observed that to be true in actual scholarship on crisis situations. It seems like there's more of a like sense of coming together. But when I'm out at the grocery store, I want a bag of rice. I want a regular bag of rice so that I can know that I can make rice multiple times a day and be sure that I will have the like calories that I need just in case all of my packaged food and all of my like quote unquote like normal food, that the everyday stuff, if that falls away, then like dry goods, beans and rice, at least I'll know I have that. And then I'm at the store just trying to make sure I have those backup beans and rice and stuff. And, you know, I see a big row of empty shelves and there's no rice. There's absolutely no dry rice. I can still find some like packages of pre-cooked $3 a bowl rice for morons, and sort of like placate myself that at least I have that. But that feeling like, you know, there's no rice, I feel like a surge of really visceral apocalypse panic, and a lot of like, I hear the laughter of like the type of preppers that I kind of like have always resisted the urge to become, the stockpilers, the people with the ammo bunkers. You know, I have maybe 200 rounds of .22 ammunition for my like squirrel shooter rifle. I'm not a big gun shooter. But I certainly didn't hoard ammo. I have like 2 weeks of food in my pantry, and I sort of feel the panic that I know the preppers are laughing at me for feeling, you know. A kind of like a calmer part of my superego comes in and says, well, the supply lines are still fine. The rice may not be in the store, but where the rice comes from, nothing has changed so far. That's all fine. The rice will come. I've since gotten my hands on a little bit of rice. But that real end of the world feeling is realer than it's ever been in the past, you know. And I was I woke up in a cold sweat last night. I did that thing where you fall asleep for like 45 minutes and then you wake up and you're just like, you know, heavy breathing and all that. And my wife's just like, why are you sitting bolt upright?
You have a bit of a panic attack.
Had the old-fashioned, falling asleep panic attack, you know, and my wife just like, why are you sitting up in bed? And I'm just like, oh, yeah, no, absolutely nothing. No, I'm just completely fine. I wasn't just having visions of like people, you know, looting a grocery store and us starving to death. It certainly wasn't that. So I wouldn't say I'm handling it well at all. I would say I'm in about as dark a place as you can. Not as dark a place as you can go, because I'm fine. I seem to be healthy. I don't have the virus.
Right. But also think about the places that are similar to us that are ahead of us, like Italy, right? Which is terrible. People are dying. Cases are spiking. Grocery stores are still open.
People are still
getting food.
Yeah.
So,
and I keep checking. I keep checking. Are grocery stores still open in Italy? I want to know the second if they aren't, if the food supply is interrupted in Italy. I don't want that information sneaking up on me. I really want to be on top of it. I like, in the same way that I want to know the worst case scenarios in good times, I am out there at the tip of the spear. The way my anxiety works is I'm out there at the tip of the spear, trying to figure out where the worst case scenarios are currently and how are they declining and becoming even worse case scenarios. I constantly got to know.
In this specific case, then, is that helping your anxiety at all, or is it making it worse?
I mean, that's the question, right? It's making me feel, I think what it's doing is it's making me feel sort of in control when I have absolutely no control. But that sense that I like have good information at least gives me that illusion. I think that's kind of where we all are. I mean, the last time we talked, I think that was during my long absence from Twitter, which was really good for my anxiety, really good for my mental health. During this, I have not been able to stay off of Twitter. That's the only place information moves fast enough.
It's a nightmare too, though.
Yeah,
and it's a nightmare. We have to be really careful because, like, misinformation and disinformation and panic also spreads on Twitter very fast. And, like, a small kind of low-stakes version of this that I watched, it was 2 or 3 days ago now. I'm working for Vice. I'm writing a lot about the coronavirus. I'm writing a lot about specifically, like, right-to-repair issues kind of around it. Like, this is how you hack ventilators to get more people on and... You know, here are people that are sharing do-it-yourself recipes for how to make your own ventilators, these kinds of things. And I'd had like 3 stories that day, and I'd shared them all on Facebook, like I normally do. And then log in a little bit later, and they'd all been flagged as spam, right? And this is the first time I'd ever had anything like this happen to me. I'm not a notorious shit poster. You know, I'm not putting lots of stuff out on Facebook. And then I'm like, oh, you know, there's a moment of like, oh God, what's happening? This is bad. They're censoring. You know, there's that flash of lizard brain panic that goes off in my brain. Then I log into Twitter and it gets worse because it's happening to everybody. And all the journalists are on Twitter. And what they're doing, we're all speculating. We're all sharing that we're being quote unquote censored. Well, it's a technical glitch. Right. But for like a couple hours, there was this mass panic amongst the journalistic class on Twitter. There was a lot of smart people that I know and respect that were sharing bad information or sharing complete speculation. That kind of stuff's not helpful. I don't know how we stop it. I don't know how we, you know, because like, you know, that lizard brain in panics and you lose a little bit of control over your actions. And I wonder if. And this is kind of something I think you kind of saw broadly as you looked at these topics in your book, if sometimes the panic and the fear and the secondary effects of something like this are so much worse than the actual problem itself.
Yeah, that's kind of what in my pandemic chapter, the one about the bacteria, not about viruses. That was one of the themes that I kept coming back to, which is that like panic is potentially as big of a problem as the actual disease itself. And I guess I was kind of telling myself that, you know, and now looking at that, it's like thinking about how slow the response to this was, I once again sort of kick myself for sort of playing the media critic when I was writing my only chapter that touched on pandemics. It wasn't about virus pandemics. It wasn't the movie Contagion. That wasn't what I was trying to write. But if I had, I would have talked about the urgency, the urgent need for testing at times like this, and the urgent need for people to be activated with social distancing and stuff like that. And like the difference between putting those measures in place quickly and efficiently and panicking in response to the media, because they are different things. And so you get, and then you get responses like Elon Musk with his like, you know, panicking about this is bullshit. You get Trump saying that it's fake news, because like it is kind of like it makes you seem cool to be like everybody's panicking for nothing. It makes you seem like a calm, collected person who like everything just sort of like bounces off of me. I know that. People are clearing out grocery stores. What a bunch of morons. Everything's fine. I'm Evangeline Lilly. My kids are still going to martial arts camp or whatever. You have to have the correct amount of fear. That is the point that I'm trying to make, in like everything that I write. you have to know how bad things are in as precise a way as you can ascertain, so that you don't just resort to one or the other, so that you don't just say it's the apocalypse, so that you don't say it's the apocalypse, fuck it, first of all, so that you don't say that, because this isn't going to extinct humanity. It's just a matter of how uncomfortable we're going to be, and how big of a tragedy it's going to be, and how much mass death there's going to be. But we're not going to go extinct from this. And so you don't want to do that. And then you also don't just want to like go to your bunker or lose your mind and become a like doomsday prepper, or the wrong kind of doomsday prepper. And you also don't want to just dismiss the whole thing. You know, if there's one thing I was trying to do when I wrote the book, for myself anyway, it's to figure out how scary things are, so that I will be, you know, emotionally ready to seek out like the facts that I need in the moment and get through it. And you know, I think we're all kind of like all bets are kind of off at this point because we were caught so totally flat-footed by this. All of our pants were down. You know, I think not to sound like Trump and be like nobody predicted this. Of course, people predicted it, but we had heard warnings about contagions in the past and had not quite processed them in this way. We had not realized what it meant. I mean, in a very literal sense, we had not processed the fact that we'd all be stuck in our houses. I had not processed the fact that if the contagion happened, that I would be right here in my office all day long, because that would be the reality. I mean, that would have been the takeaway of a chapter if I had written it, but I didn't process it that way. So having the right amount of fear, having the right amount of, you know, trying to gauge the right amount of panic, it was the concept that was trying to guide me as I wrote the book. It's like, and my book was about a different kind of pandemic than this, certainly, and it sort of like, I didn't give myself this assignment, so I can kind of forgive myself, but am I kicking myself for not envisioning this? I totally am. I totally am. I wish I could have guided people through this exact thing. And now I feel like I'm playing catch up, writing a ton about it, trying to feel some kind of sense of control. And I don't know. I don't know if I owe it to myself. I don't know if I owe it to other people. It's not like I'm everybody's resource for this kind of stuff, but in my own head, I'm like, you had one job, and it was to figure out what was the right amount of panic for something like this.
Let's take a quick break right here. You're listening to War College. We're on with Mike Pearl talking about what everybody's talking about.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, War College listeners, we are back on with Mike Pearl talking about the coronavirus. When you say we ignored warnings, are you talking about America specifically or the planet kind of more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm talking about the planet more broadly, with the exception of like the densely populated eastern coast of China, where they have like a pretty good sense of how to deal with these things, because they've dealt with a couple of them in the recent past. Japan, Korea, Singapore, they I think had all envisioned this in a clear and lucid way because they had all lived through it fairly recently. So, you know, they had things like fever clinics to send people to. They had the ability to just zap you with a thermometer gun as you're getting on the bus and usher you away to a fever clinic where you can get tested. They were able to put that infrastructure.
Explain what a fever clinic is, because this is something I learned about recently, actually. I hadn't heard about them until all of this started.
So this was something that they set up, I think, during SARS, and they had just shuttered them. They had just kind of shuttered them for the next pandemic, and then they reopened them. And what they do is they take your temperature when you're somewhere out in public, and if you have a fever, then they're going to tell you to drop what you're. They're going to make you drop what you're doing. They're an authoritarian country. They will seize the authority necessary to say, you're not going to grandma's house. You're going to a fever clinic right now, and you're going to go and figure out what you have so that we don't have a person with the virus just out there. So it's a matter of being able to figure out who's at risk in the immediate vicinity or seeing who potentially has the virus in the immediate vicinity by taking people's temperatures and then sending them to these numerous fever clinics where they'll be cohorted and tucked away. They'll be contagious but isolated until they figure out whether or not they have the pathogen of the moment. And then if they find out that they have a regular flu, then they're like, okay, you have the flu. Go home and drink some soup. Or they'll be like, well, now you need to go be isolated because you have the pathogen that we're dealing with right now. And that set of like testing and isolation procedures just keeps so many. It doesn't keep all contagious people out of the streets, off the buses, out of the trains, not in stores, but it moves so many vectors for disease into isolation that you end up seriously, it works. It like seriously reduces the amount of spread that you get in that critical first moment, you know, before it's been determined that it's a pandemic. They seriously bring down their numbers. And I mean, this was the practice that they had, especially outside of Wuhan, that like, really, really helped to slow and you know, in some ways it looks like completely halt the like rise of what at the time was just a China-wide epidemic. And in Singapore, you know, that's kind of even in some ways more authoritarian than China. It's a weird country. And they had similar and I think even more stringent testing procedures there. And that worked great. You can go to a crowded, you know, sushi restaurant and eat hand rolls that were pressed into a ball of rice that, you know, right in front of you by a sushi chef and be confident, you know, that you're not going to have, you could be doing this right now if you were in Singapore and, you know, instead we're all locked in our houses. So obviously there were people who had envisioned this for Trump to say like, oh, this totally took us by surprise. That's bullshit. It didn't take everybody by surprise. But I do think for the most part, the US, Europe, Australia, we mostly for the most part were caught completely off guard. I feel bad about that, but you know, it's not like people turn to me for information in times of every crisis. But yeah.
Something else that caught my ear as we were talking is, what's the right kind of doomsday prepper?
I mean, I don't know. We're in the process of that's what we're figuring out right now, I guess. I've consistently not had enough dish soap in my house through this process, which has resulted in me having to go to the store a lot. And you know, and every time you go to the store, no matter how careful you are, that's you're introducing so much chaos. No matter how many wipes you use on all of the hand carts and stuff like that, you still, you know, shouldn't be out there. So it's like, oh well, I am learning that I did not stockpile even reasonable stuff correctly, just to be able to stay home. I would have thought that I could stay home for 2 weeks because, you know, just as a rule of thumb, you should be able to stay home for 2 weeks. You should be able to just, whatever you're doing, you should be able to just sort of like drop everything, lock your doors, and stay inside for 2 weeks. It's not the apocalypse. It's just sort of like, you know, if you need a shelter from a hurricane, if there's some kind of natural disaster out there, as a rule of thumb, I think in the safety world, you should have 2 weeks of supplies on hand. And that's always been like the guide in the back of my head. I guess I just always figured like, I have 2 weeks of supply, give or take. I don't have like an Excel spreadsheet of all of the things that I need, but I have give or take 2 weeks of supply. And this has taught me that no, I don't. I'm totally at the mercy of the grocery store, the retail in my neighborhood, to sort of like keep myself reasonably alive and safe at home. I'm totally at the mercy of all of those silly retail establishments, those like disorganized, crappy grocery stores and various kinds of retail that you know, the all of those places that are the scenes of like meltdowns in movies about the apocalypse. Like, I still am totally dependent on those. So I did not learn even the reasonable lessons of being a prepper to my own satisfaction. I thought I had, I thought I had a handle on it, but I'm learning that I did not. So I guess that's my answer, but I don't know, because we have so much still to learn about what we're supposed to have in our houses, and we still really, really do not know what's about to happen and what we need to be ready for. You know,
now again, we're recording this on the 20th of March, and I don't know exactly when it will get out, but I'm thinking like the next 2 weeks are going to be very interesting in America.
Exactly. I know. That's what I was just thinking as I was saying all of this stuff. It's like in 3 days, are people going to be firing up this podcast and going like, I can't listen to this. This was before martial law. Like this, this is, you can't use any of this information anymore. It sounds silly now.
You know, it's weird. I've been taking a lot of comfort in dispatches from the past. Like listening to some of my favorite podcasts from like a year ago.
Some of that stuff is interesting. If you go back and listen to stuff from like 2 weeks ago, it all sounds so silly and naive.
Yeah, that's no good. Yeah, I agree. Like you have to go back like at least 6 months. But yeah, just from like very, very recently, yeah, it's no good. It doesn't work. it has to be something. I guess that's encouraging me to get this one edited and out quickly before everything's completely outdated and we sound like complete fools.
Yeah. my parents are getting information from I have this a distant relative. I don't think I'm in any way outing this like very, very distant relative who is you know, he's like a big NRA guy. He's in his 60s. He posts a lot of Facebook posts that use the cry laughing emoji. If I'm kind of like I'm trying to paint a picture of
yeah, I can I know that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's pretty well off. He has some kind of business. I think it sells, I don't know, like pharmaceutical. He's not somebody I know very well. I think he's just like owns a pharmaceutical middleman business. So he's a millionaire. And he's been feeding information to my parents who are also in their 60s. So he was one of the people, remember when that rumor went around a couple of days ago, like on Tuesday, Trump's going to shut down everything. And you know, you're gonna need to stay inside because there's not gonna be you'll only be able to go to the grocery store and everything else will be shut down. You won't be able to use your car. And then he woke up the next morning and was like, oh, that was fake news. Blah, 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 that was nonsense. So it was like, who's spreading this rumor? Well, that rumor mill is still pumping because he was on the phone with my parents last night saying like, no, that's still going to happen. And then this time there's going to be the military rolling through the streets, patrolling for looters, because there's going to be so many looters. And I was like, as my parents were telling me this, I was just like, okay, calm down. We're not there. there are like all of these health department warnings, that are telling us to shelter in place. But at the moment, it's not shelter in place or be shot. And we're not at the point yet where tanks are rolling through the streets. We're still very far from that. And as I'm saying that to my parents, I'm like, yeah, that could happen, but we're just not there yet. And like, I had not really kind of like drawn a roadmap from where we currently are to tanks rolling through the streets. And I was just like, oh man, they're only jumping the gun by like maybe a little bit. We might not get there. We might not, you know, we may well, I hope to God we don't get there, but yeah, totally conceivable.
I'm curious about this. Which state are your parents in?
Oh, they're also in California. They're also in Southern California.
So you're all in Southern California. Sir, it is a different scene here in the South where I am.
Wow.
I mean, we do have the empty grocery stores, but it just happened the last few days. And it is mostly like, if you want to go to a Kroger or a Walmart, it's going to be fairly reasonable, but the more upscale ones are the ones that are kind of wiped out. I was driving around today, just before we hopped on this podcast. I just kind of wanted to look and see like what a feel of the streets and the neighborhood were. And the Chick-fil-A was packed. Restaurants, dine-in are closed, but the drive-through for everything was completely packed. There's a Bundt cake store that is still open, and I watched two women that are post-60s kind of shuffle into it.
Today, literally, into a Bundt cake store?
Literally hours before we hopped on this call, yes.
Wow.
People here are not – it's just not the same here. It's a different culture and a different attitude, and people are not as – afraid yet. Now you go down, I live kind of on the outskirts of the main city, and you go down into the main city and it is much more deserted. But it's everyone's having a different reaction to this and panicking at different levels and afraid at different levels. And I think there's a lot of people that are going to be defiant about what they are supposed to do until it gets really, really bad, until it affects someone that's in their family, I think.
Yeah,
or no, someone
that's going to make all the difference, right? Because I really think the news consuming ethos of a lot of people is that, you know, everything that happens on the news is a cool show that doesn't really impact you, and your politics kind of only change, you know, when you have when a news event affects somebody in your like immediate family. I mean, it was like 10 years ago, there were all of these stories of like Republicans being like, I'm pro gay marriage because, you know, my daughter's gay and I realized that she deserves love or, you know, whatever. And, you know, and you just see this, and I don't mean to launch into like old fashioned partisan stuff. It sounds so outdated now, but it's just like, there are so many people in this country who really only they do not make a connection between the news and real life, and like that, I mean, that's the point I'm trying to make. It has nothing to do with gay marriage or whatever, but like the news is the news and real life is real life, and ne'er the twain shall meet. And you know, and I think a lot of us here in the city, I don't know, for whatever reason, have a much like shorter, there's much less air between what happens on the news and what happens in real life for us. Somebody else tell me why that is. But yeah, we got there. I guess we got there faster. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, I think the answers to those questions are complicated and maybe out of the purview for this particular podcast.
Right.
Little bit we did it to ourselves, little bit. Anyway, I'll just set that aside.
Yeah.
Another thing that I've been going through my mind, and that you touched on earlier in this conversation, that I want to bring it back to, and I kind of want to drill down on a little bit, is that, when we watch Walking Dead or we watch these shows about, mass panics and the apocalypse, people are fighting over bread in the grocery store aisle, and society collapses very quickly. The truth is that we have a lot of firsthand accounts and a lot of data on what happens in crisis situations. We know people have written about what it's like to live in and survive in war zones. People have lived through pandemics and written about them before. And something that I think is very interesting that I am starting to see stories about right now is that these times of stress tend to increase social bonds.
Yep.
People tend to come together.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Society doesn't fall, like life changes, civilization changes, but it doesn't collapse, right? There's no complete end of everything. People come together, especially in the communities immediately surrounding them, people come together and help each other. And that's part of how humanity has survived and thrived as long as it has. It's because we are programmed to do this. And every time something terrible happens, that comes through.
Yeah. I mean, this is everybody right now. Everybody should be reading, if they can get their hands on it, Rebecca Solnit's Paradise Built in Hell, this book about studying, how people respond to trauma in their immediate vicinity, basically, when there are natural disasters, war scenarios. There's this dichotomy between the concept that she calls elite panic and civic temper. And civic temper is this concept where outside of away from authority and away from the elites, there's this sort of we're all in this together mentality that just springs up spontaneously. And you suddenly get all of these things that up until now in news narratives are typically dismissed as holding hands and singing Kumbaya. They always say this isn't Solnit. This is me. People just don't hold hands and sing Kumbaya. When people are constantly appealing to quote unquote human nature is thought of as the idea that everyone's in it for themselves and will kill you the second they do not feel 100% comfortable. And it's taken as an article of faith, particularly in America. The minute anybody doesn't have theirs, the minute they don't feel 100% secure, they're a wild animal. They go feral, and you cannot count on anybody to help anybody else ever. And zombie fiction is based on this cultural myth, and it just does not conform to reality, basically. And the reality is that we'll come together. We don't really know what's coming, but wherever you are in the next couple of weeks, you might. There are two major hospitals about a mile from where I live. I happen to be in a hospital dense area of LA, and Children's Hospital and the Kaiser Emergency Room. LA Children's Hospital, where they do children's heart transplants. A lot of inspiring news stories happen there. And those places are going to be overrun. And it's going to, they might be. They might be overrun. It's sounding like it really could happen. And when that happens, I feel an obligation if they need me, if they say they need me, if they say people are going to die, if they can't move supplies and they just simply don't have enough people. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I'm having hero fantasies or what, but like but those places are in my neighborhood. They're close by, and everything I read is telling me that that people inside of those buildings who are in my community, who are doing things that are extremely noble and to me heroic, they're in there and they're worried. And I don't think I have an especially altruistic temperament, but if those people in there say they need my help, they need me to come out and move boxes because stuff's got to get moved, or they just need something, they need manpower, it's like, I'm here, I'm ready, I'm not doing anything, you got it. And I don't know how many people in my neighborhood feel that way, but I'm guessing it's a good percentage. and if you look at something like Paradise Built in Hell, you see that that's not in any way an unusual instinct. I'm not saying these things because I'm a good person. I'm saying these things because people, when it comes right down to it, people get worried about their community, and people become interested in their neighbors when they weren't before, and they want to help. Helping feels good. It's selfish. It feels good to help, and it pops up in times of like of stress. And you know, you wouldn't think so based on our zombie media, but that actually is what happens.
You know, I have an anecdote about this specifically. You know, I'm on. Do you know what Nextdoor is?
Of course, yes. Right, we're being encouraged to use it by the county of LA, and I.
Well, I'm on it. I'm on it right now, and I've always been on it. It's kind of a grim fascination for me because it's usually pretty terrible. And I will say that most of the time where I live, it has been like a lot of kind of paranoid crime reports and people sniping at neighbors. Yeah. And in the past 2 weeks, it's completely changed. It's a different place.
Wow.
We are setting up like, networks of people to go and get food and supplies for people that can't leave their home because of, you know, conditions that they have, or because they're older and they don't need to get out of the house. And people are setting up, like chore networks to help people out. Like it is even here where it doesn't feel like the panic has kind of taken hold as much as it has other places. That's still what some of people's first instinct is, to set up these networks and start helping each other in the neighborhood. And it happened almost overnight. So
that's amazing. I've been afraid to look at Nextdoor. I should go on there again.
You know, everyone's neighborhood's different, but I think you should look. I think it might give you a little bit of hope, actually.
Yeah, that actually sounds kind of inspiring. And I mean, here it's not even, it's LA, so it's like it has a tendency to be like a lot of like parking related stuff when you go on Nextdoor. So I have a feeling people are a lot less worried about parking than they used to be. Like there's a lot of bars and restaurants around here, and so people are like, you go on Nextdoor and it's just like people are parking in the wrong place. They're putting in a new row of restaurants. Where are the people going to park? I demand that my parking pass be respected in these streets. Blah, blah, blah. It's great. It was like, for me, Nextdoor in this neighborhood was like, it was, you know, parkingcomplaints.com. So, yeah, it sounds good. I will check it out because, like, it sounds like it could be inspiring for once.
Yeah, I think everyone's going to be, and I think this is a good lesson for us to learn, and one we maybe haven't really had since World War II in this country. People come together in times of crisis.
Yeah,
they really do, and this is going to prove that point right. With pandemics, there's always a level of paranoia because, and I think this is part of why the fear is so bad for stuff like this, is because it is invisible.
Yeah,
you know, and that's that thing that some zombie fiction speaks to, right? You don't know who's infected at the beginning, yeah. And that's going to hit us too, but I think the overwhelming need to help each other is going to win out. It in the literature and in history, it always does. It does.
I mean, it it's cause for, mixed in with your pessimism, I think that kind of thing is cause for cautious optimism. You know, when, right after 9/11, if you can cast your mind back that far, there was this whole New York post 9/11 thing where everybody was being nice to each other for like a month, and everybody was babysitting for each other's kids and checking in on each other, and everybody was smiling at each other on the streets, and that was just out of like a shared sense of like grief, basically, and a need to like manage the sort of like repairs and the big like huge crater that came from that. But like most of the city wasn't, you know, they had dust in the air, but they weren't quarantined or anything like that. And yet there was this sort of like this like time to be nice. And then we immediately turned around, and 9/11 turned into a global forever war that we're still in. And so we don't have like, we don't really have a lot of positive memories of like the fallout from 9/11. But yeah, I mean, this is an, like, hey, I have a question. Where do you think this falls on the scale of like world events? Is this are we in something more significant than 9/11? Less significant? What do you think? Where do you think it's going to fall on that scale?
Me personally, yeah. I think this will be more significant than 9/11.
Do you think this is going to? Okay, interesting. I think you're probably right. I mean, we have no idea, but it's fun to guess.
That's something I do want to stress is like, I'm just a guy that likes to read books and ask people questions.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, but yes, that's my personal opinion based on the little knowledge I've got in this world. I think this will be bigger than that. This will affect our lives more.
That's wild. And like, yeah, I was playing those guessing games with my wife the other day. So this isn't going to have nobody's projecting a death toll as high as World War II, but is this like potentially a bigger deal than World War? She was like, nah, it's not a bigger deal. And I was like, okay, fine. It's not a bigger deal than World War II, but we're having that conversation, you know?
Yeah, a couple times in every life, there's going to be two or three of these things.
Yep.
This is the second one you and I have lived through.
Yeah.
And it is going to change the way we live. I just don't know how yet. Yeah. You can't toss millions of service workers out of a job and not have repercussions that are bigger than just they're out of a job for a couple weeks. You know, like there's all these knock-on effects that are further than just the pandemic itself. Yeah, a lot of people are going to die. But there's going to be huge effects to the economy. There's going to be new legislation. It's an election year. You know, it's just, we don't know. It's going to be different. I can't tell you how. I just know it's going to be different.
Remind me, how old are you?
How old am I? 36.
Oh, we're almost the exact same age. I'm 35. So I graduated from college, and then the financial crisis just like completely knocked me on my ass, and I've lived with that as like my formative financial experience.
Yep.
And then here come the Zoomers. They were entering, you know, this extreme bear market, you know, record climbing of the Dow. Everybody was like, no, it's prosperity from here on in. How could markets don't crash? And then now we're having, you know, this is like almost certainly going to be as bad as, if not way worse than, that crisis. And another generation is financially ruined. They didn't even get to finish. They were about to finish college, and they don't even get to do that. And then they're going to enter the job market during another horrible recession. Our faith in the sort of like marketplace was totally rocked by that. The faith of the generation after us totally rocked by that. So, Yeah, I don't foresee people. I don't foresee a lot more people reading. What's his name? The guy who wrote The End of History.
Oh, Fukuyama?
Yeah, yeah. Francis. I don't see a lot of people reading Francis Fukuyama anymore and thinking like, oh yeah, everything's this is the way things are now. Everything is just it's just going to be boring. It's just going to be boring. People in suits, sort of being puppet masters of our economy, and we're all just going to kind of work in this system forever, and that's the rest of time. It looks like that's not how it's going to work out. It didn't shake out that way.
Change is the norm, right? Yeah.
Yep.
On the scale of things, changes the norm. Everything changes all the time. Nothing lasts forever. So, and it's still, like I said, still early days to even see where this is going to go.
Yeah. But I have a brain disease where I can't live in the present moment. If I'm scared of the present moment, it's because I'm scared of what I think.
You're constantly
down the line
catastrophizing all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone feels that way to a certain extent right now. Right. I think, especially if you're too online and you're plugged into the news, then it's bad. And you and I should both log off of Twitter. But I know that we can't.
I've been watching a lot of Michael Bay movies. And
really?
Yeah, that's been nice. I've enjoyed that. It's like the movie Pain and Gain, the Michael Bay movie Pain and Gain starring Mark Wahlberg and The Rock is a really, really nice escape from all of this. I can't think of anything further from COVID time than Pain and Gain, the movie directed by Michael Bay. Highly recommend. 10 out of 10.
Producer Kevin Nodell, who isn't with us at the moment, which I'll explain why in a minute. It's not good. Also a huge fan of Pain and Gain, actually.
Wow, okay.
And he's been trying to get me to watch it for forever.
Oh, well, I mean, run, don't walk.
I'm going to wrap things up here. Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show and working through both of our anxieties.
Thanks for having me. I will continue trying to figure out whether I'm doing it right or wrong, but it was good to talk about it.
Absolutely. And kind of to let you guys know what's going on with Kevin, he was in the Middle East, or he is in the Middle East, doing a bunch of reporting there. He's probably going to try to call in here in the next week or two to do an episode about kind of what COVID looks like from what he's seeing and how it's kind of, you know, screwing up a war. But at the moment, he was set to fly back at the end of March. I believe his flight has just been canceled, and he's trying to figure out a way to get out of the Middle East as we speak. And like so many other things, we don't know what's going to happen.
Jesus Christ. Wow.
Yeah. But again, you come to War College to be to hear that depressing ending, so I've given it to you. Thank you so much for listening, and please be safe out there.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.